Morning, Mr. Khalil.
Morning, Your Honor.
We start with a fundamental principle of our criminal justice system. The prosecutorial power is not absolute. There are limits. Due process requires that law enforcement officers, like prosecutors, obtain judicial approval before imposing significant deprivations of liberty or property. In November 2005, the appellant in this case, Mr. Jones, was a pretrial detainee in the D.C. jail. Rachel Lieber was one of the U.S. attorneys prosecuting his case. She contends that at that time she came into possession of information that caused her to be concerned about the integrity of the prosecution, moreover, the safety of potential witnesses in the case. She alleges that she feared Jones was trying to locate potential witnesses and potentially harm them.
You don't seriously challenge the sincerity of her observations, do you, counsel?
I do not. I think the point, though, that I would like to make is that the principle in the case is that there could be a time when a prosecutor is not acting well, and that is the that's the issue.
I'm pushing you toward the chase, if you would.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. So the point is that she had these concerns, and what she wanted to do to resolve them was to have Mr. Jones placed into detention, segregation. She wanted to be able to cut off his communication with the outside world. And it's where she took the next step and how she acted on those concerns that we differ with the government. We argue that at this point she should have gone to a court and presented her concerns, and the court could have engaged in the business of weighing the competing interests involved. That's something that courts do all the time, and courts are especially good at, and something that a court actually did do in this case just months later.
Is there any law on that?
We look to the principles established in cases like Gerstein v. Pugh and McNabb v. United States, where we know that
I know in the pretrial, the Bail Reform Act, the prosecutor is before a judge. Now, in this instance, the prosecutor gets information concerning potential witnesses in her case. So she contacts the jail. Anything wrong so far?
I do not think so. I think if she...
So is your concern about the nature of her instructions?
It is.
In other words, she didn't say, protect my witnesses. She gave very specific instructions. Now, is that the nature of your focus here?
That's a big part of it, because in essence, we argue there was no discretion exercised by the prison officials. The discretion was exercised by the prosecutor about what should be done in a prison, which is a concern. But also,
so in a 12b6 case, is it your position then that the judge needed to hear evidence about the nature of the restrictions?
If the restrictions are going to be so significant, I think that is required. Yes, because according to Mr. Jones's complaint, it wasn't just these new deprivations were not trivial. He was so completely isolated that it affected his ability to there's strong law that your ability to maintain familiar relationships is of constitutional import. And here he was completely cut off. It's not just that he couldn't see them or talk to them. He couldn't hear of them. He couldn't write to them. He couldn't get letters from them. He couldn't telephone them.
So you're arguing, are you, that because of the nature of the prosecutor's instructions, your client may have stated a claim for excessiveness? I'm trying to get you to put this back in court for me.
Sure.
As distinct from what, in an ideal world, we might want to have happened.
Sure. In essence,
Are you saying that the prosecutor in this case had no alternative other than to go to a judicial officer?
For an extended, indefinite detention order like the one she sought.
Now, that's your argument? I just want to be clear.
Yes, it is.
All
Thank you. And we would also concede that if there were exigent circumstances in this case, if, for example, Judge Huvel was unavailable to hear the motion, and there was a concern that time was of the essence, certainly it would be reasonable and consistent with constitutional principles that you contact the jail officials and you say, please put him away for 24 hours while we sort this out and while I get in front of a judge. But to present these terms for such an indefinite period of time that are so significant.
When did that right attach? It, you're not, I take it, saying that every prisoner who has a change in his conditions of confinement, every pretrial prisoner has a change in conditions of confinement, has a right to go to a judge to be heard on the change in conditions, are you?
No, and certainly not. And this would be a much different case if those change in conditions were resulted from some sort of prison administrative operation. You know, if he had tried to escape, and this discipline was meted out as a result of the normal.
You would not say that he had a right to be heard by a judge if he tried to escape and then was confined.
Right, and I mean, we'd look at it under Bell v. Wolfish, I think, at that point, and then.
Okay, but taking that further, the prosecutor finds or has reason to believe that this man is potentially interfering with witnesses, and the record here shows that one of these witnesses was in the same detention facility. I don't understand why it's improper for the prosecutor to call the jail officials.
I don't say it's improper to call the jail officials and let them know, and then say, you know, I have this concern. Please do with it what you will. But I do think it's improper, and what we argue is improper here is to say, I have a concern, place this prisoner in segregation, cut off his phone communications, but not articulate why the.
I just need you to spell this out a little bit for me. The prosecutor calls the warden and says, you need to segregate this person. He's potentially threatening witnesses. And furthermore, there's a witness in the jail with him. And I want you to do these 10 things. And the warden says, I'll do 4 of them. And the prosecutor says, that's not good enough. Then, is your point the prosecutor has to go to a judicial? Your point is it has to be at the very beginning. I'm just trying to understand who's making the decisions here about what happens to Mr. Jones. The prison officials say at some point, or the jail officials say at some point, it's by court order. Other instances, they finally own up. It's because the prosecutor told them to do it.
Well, here's what I think should have happened, or here's what I would think should happen in such a case. The prosecutor calls up the warden and says, I have this concern. I think that he's a threat to one of your, a fellow prisoner. And if the warden at that point says, you know what, I think that's good enough for me, I think that's right. Under our administrative procedures, when we get that sort of information, we have a hearing board and we, whatever sort of due process.
Well, suppose the warden says, I'll take care of it, period.
Right.
Then the prosecutor finds out, in fact, the warden has not segregated the person, has not taken away his telephone privileges, and she calls him back and says, take away his telephone privileges, take away his visiting privileges.
At that point, she's attempting to impose a new liberty deprivation upon the prisoner for assuredly legitimate government goals, but not penal goals. And at that point, pretrial detainees are not robbed of all due process rights. I mean, if these are, you know, your ability to, as I said, communicate with your family and your ability to help assist in your defense are vital constitutional interests. He was, because of this order, he was unable to have meaningful access to the law library. He was unable to contact potential witnesses in his case. He was unable to even contact.
That was gold in part. That he shouldn't be able to contact potential witnesses in his case. That was afraid of.
And
he couldn't confer with counsel. He couldn't receive mail.
I think
he was in lockdown, basically.
I think he had limited access to counsel.
He did. All right.
Limited.
What does that mean?
He alleges that his ability to phone call to have telephone conversations with counsel was interfered with, but otherwise. as a matter of the order or the restrictions, he was ostensibly supposed to have unlimited access.
Yeah, he had unlimited, at least ostensibly. Right. Okay. I know we've talked you past your time. We'll give you some back, but I did want to say, is there anything left of the claim against the police officer?
Well, we think that you're familiar with the reasons cited in the order for dismissing the claim against the police officer, concession, basically. And Mr. Jones says he never received the notice of the order or the actual order itself. We think that fairness should require that he have at least an opportunity to respond on the merits. What he'll have to say on those merits. Yeah.
The search warrant is the gist of the claim against the officer, right?
Yes.
And the search warrant's been upheld in another proceeding, right?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah, and so isn't there some race judicata problem here, or?
Well,
preclusion of some sort.
I mean, my understanding.
He was a party to the other proceeding, and the search warrant was upheld, right?
Well, the detective was not a party to the other proceeding.
Mr. Jones was.
Mr. Right. Jones was a party, but his constitutional claim, or excuse me, his 1983 claim never came up on the merits as a matter of that. So.
But it depends on the search warrant being invalid, right?
I don't believe it depends on the search warrant being invalid. It depends on whether the truth or falsity of the statements that she made in that search warrant.
How could a court hold that they were false when the search warrant's already been upheld by another court, the same court?
I agree that would present.
I'm not sure there's anything left of that.
I agree it would present some difficulties.
Okay, thank you. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if needed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Good morning, Alan Birch, for AOSA Rachel Lieber. The district court's holding on with respect to Lieber was correct, both because of the lack of a constitutional violation and because of she would have been protected by qualified immunity. Before I get to those,
protected by absolute immunity.
Excuse me.
Why is she not protected by absolute immunity?
I believe she is also protected by absolute immunity, as we mentioned in our brief. The district court didn't touch
right.
the issue. But you certainly could affirm on those grounds as well.
Has any court held that absolute immunity applies when it's outside of a judicial hearing or proceeding for a prosecutor? I thought the rationale for absolute immunity for the prosecutor was because the court basically couldn't proceed, as distinct from investigative activities and
the distinction,
you know,
between in-court,
yeah.
in-court and out-of-court behavior, essentially. Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. The language in the court decision that we cited in our brief does talk about the judicial criminal justice system and the judicial part there. I'm going to find that.
You've got that language from Burns, that it involves actions preliminary to the initiation and actions apart from the courtroom.
Yeah, her actions were, quote, intimately associated with the judicial phase of the criminal process, unquote. That's quoting from my brief, which is in turn quoting from the Atherton case from this court.
Atherton talks about the limits. I don't think that's
right. The holding in Atherton is adverse to us, certainly. But the language in Atherton is referring to the judicial phase of the criminal process, and certainly her actions fall within that language.
Well, I was looking at the Supreme Court's decision in Kalina. Are you familiar with
not
that?
Not familiar with that one.
You are?
No, sorry.
It was decided in 1997. And it draws a distinction here as far as absolute immunity is concerned. And, of course, you say we don't need to go that far anyway.
That's correct. I understand it.
Qualified immunity here, at least, you'd say.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, though, mm-hmm. you heard my questions to counsel. What is the government's position as to what's supposed to happen? You say the prosecutor properly contacted the jail officials.
Right.
So Is it the United States government's position that the discretion resides with the D.C. jailer as to how to respond to the prosecutor's instructions about what she wants done?
Ultimately, yes, Your Honor. We don't want to get into a situation where we're pointing fingers with the district about whose job it is, because we want to work collaboratively.
So if the prosecutor says, I want the following 10 things done,
right,
and the warden says, I'll do 4, and she says, no, I need the other 6, then is it your position she has to go to a judicial officer?
As a practical matter, if she feels that strongly about it, then yes. I mean, she's not in control, ultimately, of the jail. Now, the relationship that we have doesn't bubble up to that.
Well, in this case, she contacted the jailer,
mm-hmm.
and presumably he heard her request. And then she found out later that, in fact, all that she wanted had not been done. So she called back and said no, or she wrote.
Right.
She wrote back.
Said, I want the following things done.
Well, the second request was essentially the same as the first request, and it was...
Well, that's my hypothetical. She wanted
right.
10 things done. He took care of
4. Okay.
She found that, no, he hadn't done the other 6, so she wrote him.
Okay.
Pretty strongly worded letter, too. She wanted an investigation as to why it hadn't been done already.
Certainly. She wanted an explanation. It was important.
If she has no right to demand of the warden, and I'm not asking you to get in finger pointing,
mm-hmm.
why does she think she's entitled to an explanation? Or certainly not an investigation. I understand your proposition that she's not in the warden's chain of command, but that letter reads as if she is when she says, I want an investigation as why this hadn't been done the way I said to do it the first time. Unless she's in charge, who is she to be here?
That's perhaps overheated rhetoric, Your Honor. There aren't any sort of legal implications of it, because she doesn't have authority to enforce it per se. She's not the head of the jail. You could criticize the language as being overheated, perhaps, but it's of no moment.
Overheated language is a pretty gentle way to describe it when she seems to be...
It's an important thing that she's trying to defend, Your Honor. The allegations and information she's come across is very serious, and she needs to take it very seriously.
But look what happened in this case is what we're trying to, at least I'm trying to get a hold of it.
Right.
In other words, when it finally went to a judicial officer, the judicial officer modified the conditions significantly.
And indeed,
the prosecutor acknowledged that no investigation had been done as to what was, you know, minimally required here.
Certainly.
Just piggybacking on the Chief Judge's questions, I mean, Bell v. Wolfish was looking at the situation from the perspective of the administrator of the detention facility or a correctional facility, not the prosecutor's protection and perspective. And I mean, presumably the prosecutor would prefer to have everybody isolated.
Perhaps I can't speak.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of all these drug cases where there are implications of influencing witnesses, intimidating witnesses. That's what I'm trying to understand about whose responsibility is it here.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the decision is the jailer's responsibility.
Jailer's responsibility.
Yeah. If I could get back to one of the points that you were raising with Amicus, I see my time's way over. But
we'll give you a little bit longer, but not much. Quickly.
With respect to the point about access to counsel, he was not denied access to the attorney remained free to come in and visit. If you see the allegations at the complaint on page 34, he says he was denied a call to his lawyer. Similarly, at A89, he says he was denied legal calls. These are implying outgoing calls. But the program statement makes clear that the lawyer remains free to come visit 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's in D.C. Department of Corrections Program Statement 4160.3F. It's on the website. There's nothing in the record that would suggest that was ever cut off.
It's not exactly consistent with her direction to the warden, however.
Well, it remains consistent with our point that the warden remains in control. She's not dictating the terms.
I think I understand the point that Jones is not exactly a sympathetic figure in this, but nevertheless, he does have these rights that the Supreme Court has
certainly acknowledged. And it's undisputed that those rights are properly viewed under Bell,
and,
Bell is a very lenient standard.
No visits, except you say maybe his attorney. No mail, not even incoming mail. He's in his cell, what is it, 23 out of 24 hours, and when he leaves, he's in shackles.
He's not yet been convicted of anything.
The shackles are not part of the request. The request was to segregate.
Segregation. And that one of my questions is, did the prosecutor have any idea what happens when you ask the jailer to put a pretrial detainee in segregation?
Well, it's not in the record, Your Honor, and you would, under
the... Does the prosecutor have any responsibility to know?
The responsibilities would be delineated by Bell versus Wolfish, Your Honor, and that standard, you don't need to get anywhere near that granular to make
the holding. That's looking at it from the perspective of the warden, not the perspective of the prosecutor.
There isn't any different law for the perspective of the prosecutor. If there were, then the qualified immunity would be even stronger.
There isn't any, is what I'm trying to get at, unless you get...
In that case, then perhaps the easier way to resolve the case is qualified immunity, where you would have to say that there's no clearly established right that's been violated by the prosecutor.
No clearly established right as to...
No clearly established that there is any right that she's violating by making the request to put him in segregation.
Well, Bell versus Wolfish at least establishes that the pretrial detainee has constitutional protections.
Of course.
All right.
Of course.
Yeah.
And with that, I would request that the judgment with respect to Ms. Lieber be affirmed. Thank you.
Hear from the other appellee.
Good morning. Mary Wilson representing the defendants Horn and Harrison. The court should affirm the trial court's judgment dismissing the case as to both of these defendants because there's no showing of any constitutional violation, and in any event, Harrison is entitled to qualified immunity. Putting in context the jail's reaction to the communications from the U.S. attorney, first, Hewitt v. Helms says that a jail has to make subjective evaluations and predict future behavior in terms of safety and security at the jail, and can act on rumor, reputation, and even more imponderable factors.
Now, this is not safety and security at the jail per se, though. This has to do with rumors of interference with witnesses.
Well, there's the safety of the general public, the witnesses outside the jail, and as Judge Rogers pointed out, there is evidence that one of the witnesses was in the jail.
That helps you.
Yes, and the jail has to make these determinations, incarcerating close to 3,000 people.
But in this case, the record shows that the prosecutor called the warden, and the warden didn't do everything she wanted him to do.
Yes.
And then she wrote and told him to do more.
Yes.
And he did it.
Yes.
And the explanation is the prosecutor told me to do it. It's not a situation where the warden has said, I determined for the safety and security of the institution that I needed to do more than I had already done in response to the prosecutor's request.
Well, based on the deference that courts owe prison administrations, it was certainly the jail's prerogative that should not be second-guessed by the court system as to what weight and credence to give these calls from the attorney. I mean, certainly if a lawyer calls and says, I have information that people in the public are at risk, that there are safety and security issues, that we have information that one of your detainees is attempting to commit crimes from the jail, certainly that's an interest that Bell, although Bell dealt with...
What I'm trying to get at is that with the war on drugs and all the cases I've seen, people who are in detention are always writing letters, calling, talking about their cohorts, concerned about who may be cooperating with the government. So under that theory, you know, the jailer would put everybody in segregation and lockdown.
Well, yes, that would certainly...
All right, but that's not the law.
Well, that's one of the challenges of operating the jail. You have to protect co-defendants from each other and gang members and witnesses.
And what evidence is there in this case that the prosecutor's additional requests were things that the warden thought were necessary for the protection of the jail?
It was the warden's prerogative to act based on the recommendation of the U.S. attorney. Just as Hewitt says you can act on rumor and reputation, if the federal prosecutor, and you know they were monitoring calls from the jail and had information from his cell, it was the jail official's prerogative on what weight to give that call from the U.S. attorney. And it was their prerogative that shouldn't be second-guessed by the courts to accept her assertion that there was a risk. And under Bell and all the other Supreme Court authorities, the federal courts should not be second guessing. I mean, if you can act on rumor, you can certainly act on at the request of a federal prosecutor.
Could the jail simply put a pretrial detainee in segregation for no apparent reason?
Yes, if there's no evidence that's intended to punish the detainee for the crimes for which he is charged, and that's a reasonable relationship to managing the jail, then yes, there's no...
So this freedom from being second-guessed is absolute? The jailer can do anything he wants with regard to degrees of confinement to a pretrial detainee?
As long as it's not punishment and within the general limits of the Constitution, yes.
What do you understand the district court, Judge Havel, to have done here once she did have a crack at the conditions of detaining?
Well, we would submit that Judge Havel did not grant the jail the appropriate deference to how to manage this volatile situation, that ordering the jail to monitor the phone calls and monitor the visits, that whether the jail could do that in terms of juggling everything else, that was improper interference with the jail's prerogative in how to handle this situation.
Was that the district's position before Judge Havel?
The district did not appear before Judge Havel.
Did the district go and ask Judge Havel to reconsider her orders?
No. I mean...
Right. So, I mean, there's nothing like that in this case.
No, we're not asking the court to... Again, it's the jail's prerogative. If
you are arguing for an essentially boundless prerogative, though, for the jailer to decide.
Well, the court doesn't have to go that far here. Certainly, the record shows that the jail makes an effort to keep people in general population if it thinks it can do so safely. It made that initial decision here, altered that decision in response to information and a request from the U.S. attorney.
I mean, it was necessary for the protection of the facility to deny him incoming mail?
Yes. Well, certainly incoming mail could give him information about snitches that might be confined within the jail. It might give him information about who's snitching out in the community. If there's some, the system's not perfect, if he got communication, if he was then able to communicate outside the jail, that under the circumstances...
Does the Bail Reform Act provide any guidance here?
You'd have to ask the U.S. attorney. I don't generally deal with the Bail Reform Act.
Experienced appellate advocate, and the District of Columbia is familiar with the Bail Reform Act. Well, I mean, that statute passed by Congress indicates there are certain standards for when you deprive a pretrial detainee of liberty. All right, now,
yes,
judgment was made by a judicial officer here.
Yes. Certainly, the district court made the initial decision that he should be held pre-trial. And then it was the jail's responsibility to hold him safely, keep him safe, keep him from harming other people, and keep him from committing crimes from within the jail. And that jail exercises discretion on how to do that here. And frequently, judges give the jail information about a prisoner's medical condition or information they have, and then the jail acts on that information and acted on Judge Fell's order here. But again, this is in the jail juggling its responsibility. It exercised an abundance of caution here to act based on the U.S. Attorney's recommendation, and then based on Judge Hovell's order, stepped back and altered his placement. So to conclude, there was no constitutional violation. If there was, Mr. Harrison is certainly entitled to qualified immunity. And on Ms. Horn, unless there are questions, we submit that Jones is improperly raising the issue for the first time in appeal. It was already declared a valid search warrant in the criminal case, and for the other reasons we set forth in our brief.
So your position, let me just be clear, is that Harrison was the decision maker here?
No. Harrison, above him in the Department of Corrections, is both the deputy director of the Department of Corrections and the director of the Department of Corrections. So we submit that Harrison, as the acting warden of the jail, was, if you're addressing the district's liability, that Harrison was not a decision maker who could set policy in this matter.
And are there any, if you know, any written standards that the, is there a DC Department of Corrections?
Yes.
That department has issued for the detention of pretrial detainees?
I think there are published regulations dealing with administrative segregation and discipline at the jail. But there is no claim here of any local law violation. There's no citation
to
this.
I'm trying to understand, are we talking about unlimited discretion, or has the District of Columbia already placed certain limitations on the warden's discretion, or no?
I believe there are regulations addressing discipline and administrative segregation at the jail, and in fact, the warden's memo reflects compliance with those. It says you had a hearing with the housing board, and you've had follow-up. So the warden indicates there was compliance with the local law there. So he is. That's a good point, Your Honor. Thank you. He's not exercising his judgment to set policy. He's merely assuring that the officials at the jail complied with the regulations in effect. Ask the court to affirm.
We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Khalil.
Thank you. Just two very brief points. First, on the issue of who was the, what the basis was for this decision. On A74 of our appendix, we inserted the memo from Mr. Harrison to Mr. Jones, stating the reasons for his confinement conditions. And it says, in response to your grievance to the housing board, there was a housing hearing on December 15th, 2005 to determine your housing status. Per the U.S. Attorney's Office request, you're to be placed on total separation from the general population, also phone restriction and mail privileges. Now, because of all the language in Bell v. Wolfish about deference, this seems in a lot of ways similar to an administrative review case. And when you think about that, the record, even when you give deference, the record has to match the result. And here, it is not satisfying or acceptable to say, well, I exercise my discretion by just deferring to the prosecutor. That there is no matchup there that we would submit. On the qualified immunity point, we would just like to point out to other instances in other areas of law involving pretrial detainees where there are clearly established rights. And we pointed in the brief to the case of Selby, United States, where a pretrial detainee who is mentally unwell and the government wants to administer antipsychotic drugs to him against his will, there needs to be a showing to a court. There's also cases where pretrial detainees, where a prosecutor might want to gain a DNA sample from a pretrial detainee to address the compelling government interest of solving unsolved crimes. But again, you would need to go to a court officer and obtain a warrant for that sort of deprivation. Similarly, where you have a pretrial detainee whose assets have been seized.
You need to wind it up, Mr.
All right. Well, thank you, Your Honor. We do not concede that there's clearly established law here. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your appearance as pro bono and the service you're performing to the court and to the United States. We're always proud of the behavior of the D.C. Bar, and you've done it proud today. Thank you very much.